Sikh, thank you for your very generous and kind remarks. Can I say, Lady President, Mr. President, immediate past, honorary fellows and fellows of the Academy, Secretary of Health, Welfare, Food and Environment, ladies and gentlemen, I would like to begin by thanking the Academy for the privilege and honor to deliver the David Todd Oration this year. It is customary on occasions like this to present to you a picture of the person to whom this lecture is dedicated. However, I feel that it is superfluous to do so today. Firstly, David is well known to all of us, and he comes back to Hong Kong several times a year. Secondly, we have already got a beautiful portrait of him in full academic splendor on the wall of the staircase of this building. Like other developed countries, the population demography and the pattern of diseases in Hong Kong have undergone tremendous changes in the 20th century. In place of infectious diseases such as tuberculosis, the leading causes of death at present are malignancies and degenerative diseases such as cardiovascular disease and stroke. The major factors which brought about these changes were improvement in public health and advances in medicine and medical sciences. We now have a better understanding of the causation of most diseases, the means of making early diagnosis, and more effective modalities of treatment. As a result, communicable diseases have assumed a diminishing importance in the minds of the medical profession and the public. The outbreak of SARS in 2002 and 2003 came as a big surprise, and the whole world was caught unprepared. SARS, or severe acute respiratory syndrome, is the first new infectious disease, and I'm sure it won't be the last, of the 21st century that poses a threat to international health. It originated in southern China in November 2002, spread to Hong Kong in February the following year, and then rapidly worldwide, mostly to Asian countries. At the end of the epidemic, in July 2003, it has infected more than 8,000 people with 774 deaths. In addition to human suffering and the loss of lives, the devastation inflicted by SARS on tourism, business and the economy worldwide was unprecedented in the history of modern medicine. It was a severe challenge to Hong Kong, a personal tragedy for many of its citizens, and a heavy blow to its healthcare sector. The Hong Kong government and the healthcare sector were poorly prepared for the sudden emergence and the rapid spread of SARS, which was at first an unknown disease with an unknown etiology, and our response was less than satisfactory. The government commissioned an independent SARS expert committee to review the work of the government, including the hospital authority, in the management of the outbreak, to identify lessons to be learned and to make recommendations on areas of improvement to prepare for possible future attacks. At the conclusion of the review in October 2003, the committee made a total of 46 recommendations. Almost simultaneously, the hospital authority also initiated a similar review focusing on the work of the hospital authority. Later that year, the Legislative Council established a select panel to examine the same issues, and its report was published in early July. It is now more than a year after the end of the epidemic, and I think it is the right time for us to reflect once more on what was learned from the outbreak. Your kind invitation for me to address you this evening gives me the opportunity to look at the whole saga again, this time viewing it at arm's length from the standpoint of one who was not at the storm's eye during the epidemic, and also after the lapse of a reasonable period. I'll try to look at it more objectively, more dispassionately, and perhaps more analytically as well. I'll not bother you with the details of what happened, nor the details of the expert committee recommendations. I only wish to share with you my thoughts on a philosophical rather than technical manner. Perhaps a few key events are worth mentioning in chronological order. First, early warning. As early as November 2002, there were rumors that a large number of residents in Guangdong province came down with an unusual respiratory illness. Around Chinese New Year on the 10th of February 2003, there were media reports of an outbreak of atypical pneumonia in Guangzhou. Unfortunately, there was a lot of background noise, all confusing factors at the same time, such as the occurrence of avian flu in Fujian province and the announcement by the China Center for Disease Control and Prevention that the probable causative agent of the epidemic was chlamydia, a known virus. The Hong Kong Department of Health failed to obtain more information from China. A confidential report produced by the Guangdong Health Bureau for the central government concerning the epidemic was also not available to Hong Kong. Nevertheless, the Hospital Authority Head Office convened a working group on the 11th of February to establish a surveillance system for cases of atypical pneumonia in public hospitals. Unfortunately, because of the large number of atypical pneumonia cases admitted into public hospitals each month, the working group decided to focus only on cases of severe and underlying severe community-acquired pneumonia or severe CAP. This was a sensible decision at the time, but as we shall see later, it has some undesirable consequences. The case of Professor Lau, the index case of the Metropole outbreak, the case transfer from Union Hospital to Prince of Wales Hospital, and the case transfer from Hanoi to Hong Kong were all identified by the surveillance system for severe CAP. But the index patient for the outbreak in PWH was not captured by the system, as his presentation was much milder and he did not qualify for the definition of severe, i.e. requiring intensive care or assisted ventilation. His admission into Ward 8A of PWH did not trigger the usual infection control precautions. Second, the SARS outbreak in PWH began on the 10th of March. The index patient infected a total of 143 persons, including 50 healthcare workers and 17 medical students. The large number of people infected was mainly due to the use of nebulizer treatment for several days without realizing the patient was infectious, and hence no infection control measures were introduced. Third, because Professor Lau from Guangzhou was reported to the Department of Health as severe CAP, case investigation was carried out on the 24th of February. Despite information that he and his wife stayed at the Hotel Metropole on the 21st and 22nd of February, contact tracing did not include the people staying or visiting the hotel. The reason given was that the practice at that time was to trace close contacts and not places, and that there was no indication that environmental factors were involved. In retrospect, this decision was wrong. It was revealed on the 19th of March that the index patient and PWH had visited the hotel around that time. Fourth, the index patient for the Amoy Gardens outbreak normally lived in Shandun. It was a patient with chronic renal failure receiving regular hemodialysis at Prince of Wales Hospital. He stayed overnight at the Amoy Gardens on the 14th of March before being admitted to Ward 8A the next morning. He was running a fever, had chest x-ray changes, and possible contact with atypical pneumonia in Shandun. A clinical diagnosis of atypical pneumonia was made. However, a few days later, an alternative diagnosis of influenza was made, after influenza A virus was cultured from his nasopharyngeal aspirate and he appeared to respond to treatment with antiviral agent and antibiotics. He was discharged on the 19th of March. He was readmitted to Prince of Wales Hospital 3 days later after rapid deterioration of his clinical condition and he required intubation. A total of 213 residents in Amoy Gardens were infected, with 107 from Block E where he stayed. It was again unfortunate that the possibility of recrudescence of the disease was not known at that time, and the patient was allowed to go home on 19th of March. Later in the SARS epidemic, such patients would be transferred to a step-down ward for 14 days or so before discharge home. I mention these incidents not to find fault with any individual, but to illustrate the importance of being always alert to the emergence of new communicable diseases at this day and age. If we were aware of this possibility, we would be adopting more flexibility and greater thoughtfulness in the adoption of so-called routine guidelines, such as the criteria for severe CAP, contact tracing, or even discharge of patients from isolation wards. Of course, my criticism is after the event. However, what happens in Hong Kong then contrasts strongly with the prompt action of a true SARS hero, Dr. Carlo Urbani. The Vietnam French Hospital of Hanoi admitted the patient with unusual influenza-like illness on the 28th of February 2003. This was the beginning of the SARS epidemic in Vietnam. Dr. Urbani was asked to help with the investigation. He swiftly determined that the small private hospital was facing something unusual. He worked directly with the medical staff of the hospital, documenting findings, arranging for samples to be sent for testing, and reinforcing infection control. The hospital established an isolation ward, and many of the staff members were quarantined. What followed was a story of what could go right if public health took precedence over politics. Through Dr. Urbani's insistence and persuasion, the Vietnam authorities alerted the WHO of a new atypical pneumonia epidemic, and extraordinary steps were taken to quarantine the Vietnam French hospital, to introduce infection control procedures in other hospitals, and to issue an international appeal for expert assistance. These measures were responsible for containing the outbreak in Vietnam within a short time. Unfortunately, Dr. Urbani did not survive to see the success of his efforts, and he succumbed to SARS on the 29th of March. Perhaps it is unfair for me to cite the example of Dr. Urbani, who was an expert in infectious diseases working at the WHO. I reiterate that being vigilant is the first requirement to combat communicable disease, new or old. Communicable diseases do not respect any territorial barriers. The speed, convenience, and frequency of international travel by air, land, and sea will spread communicable diseases to any region in the world within a matter of hours. The need for being vigilant applies not only to the government and health authorities, it should apply to all healthcare personnel as well as the general public. The SARS Expert Committee, of which I was privileged to be a member, made 46 recommendations, grouped into one organization and structure, two collaboration, coordination, and communication, and three management of the epidemic. Again, I'll not bother you with the details of each recommendation, and I understand that the relevant authorities, i.e. the Bureau of Health, Welfare and Food, the Hospital Authority, and the Department of Health, have made every effort to implement these recommendations, and more recently, in June this year, the Center for Health Protection was established. In late 2003 and early 2004, there were outbreaks of SARS in Singapore, Guangzhou, and Beijing, confined mainly to laboratory staff and their close contacts. And fortunate for us, there was no case of SARS reported in Hong Kong, despite the frequent and large numbers of visitors from China. I think the whole world, and not only Hong Kong, has learned from the bitter lessons of SARS epidemic last year. Nevertheless, I don't think this is all we need to do or should do to ward off any new communicable disease. I think it is time we should take this opportunity to review how well our healthcare system is doing and what problems are and what improvements should be made. I focus just on a few themes. As mentioned earlier, the overriding issue is to be vigilant and be prepared for the outbreak of new and emerging communicable disease. We need to have a high index of suspicion when faced with any unusual illness occurring in the community. And to do this, we need to have the knowledge base, the mindset, and the culture among the healthcare sector to be inquisitive, rational, and open-minded. To be prepared, we again require the setup of a system or mechanism to follow up the detection of the first suspect case, and the ability to mobilize a sufficient number of personnel with appropriate training to deal with the emergency. We therefore require, one, more emphasis paid to the training of healthcare personnel in public health and preventive medicine. As I mentioned earlier, the pattern of diseases in Hong Kong has changed tremendously in the recent years. Degenerative diseases and malignancies have taken over from infections in communicable disease as the main cause of morbidity and mortality. At the same time, rapid progress in medical science has improved the diagnosis and treatment of many inherited congenital and acquired diseases affecting mankind. The cost of healthcare is escalating. The knowledge base and the skill required for doctors to practice medicine have increased significantly. It is now impossible for a new graduate, MBBS or MBCB, to practice all facets of medicine. Graduates have to pursue years of specialty or even subspecialty training to qualify for fellowship of this academy. They will also need to undertake continuing medical education even after such qualification. This is good practice, as it is in line with international trend. It also delivers the best and most up-to-date medical care to the patients. But unfortunately, in the process of developing specialties and because of the prevalent culture, primary care and public health have not received the same emphasis in the medical schools and hospitals. Family doctors are the gatekeepers, and they play the sentinel role in alerting the Department of Health, the hospital authority, and now the Center for Health Protection of any known or unknown emerging communicable disease. We therefore need to strengthen the curriculum in public health and family medicine in both medical schools to inspire and attract more graduates to take up a career in public health and family medicine. This is, of course, more easily said than done. It involves resources, incentives, and last but not least, a change in the mindset and culture of the entire medical profession. I'm glad to see that after SARS, with encouragement of the government and the provision of funding from the $500 million Research Fund for the Control of Infectious Diseases, things are taking shape. Both universities have now established centers for research and training in public health, and the recently established Center for Health Protection should be able to play an important role in coordinating and providing such training to all healthcare workers in Hong Kong. Second, research. The same applies to research. The discovery of the SARS coronavirus by the University of Hong Kong, the identification of the genomic sequence of the virus, and the development of laboratory diagnostic tests by both universities have helped us contain the outbreak of the epidemic. They also have also put Hong Kong on a world map of viral research. The discovery that the civet cat as a possible reservoir of the virus also helps us to break the chain of infection from animals to humans. The research fund mentioned above has commissioned the University of Hong Kong, the Chinese University of Hong Kong, and the consortium comprising the Hong Kong University of Science and Technology, the Hong Kong Polytechnic University, and the Hospital Authority to conduct a wide range of research on epidemiology, clinical trials, public health, etc., including the establishment of a third-level research laboratory. This is a welcome approach, as public health research has by tradition attracted disproportionately less public funding than other areas of medical research. Third, we need close collaboration among the government departments, the hospital authority, and the universities in research and clinical practice. The SARS epidemic has taught us the disadvantage of compartmentation and the dire consequence of not sharing information with each other. Hong Kong is a small place. Our expertise and funding in research are relatively limited, though our research output, both in quantity and quality, is admirable. I'm glad to see that the SARS epidemic is a awakening call for all parties, especially the two medical schools, that they should collaborate closely when facing a common challenge, such as overcoming communicable disease. Fourth, healthcare reform and better organization of healthcare in the public and private sectors is needed. The expert committee report pointed out a number of system failures in response to the epidemic, particularly in the early phase. Quote, lessons must be learned and there is much that needs to be done to strengthen the public health function, to improve the coordination of the different parts of the healthcare sector, to provide clarity in roles and responsibilities, and to improve communication, unquote. The report also touches on the interface between the public and the private sectors in the provision of healthcare. These are urgent and vital issues which are being debated in the community, and I'm afraid that it would require another David Todd oration to be given in later years to discuss it. What good has come from the SARS epidemic? First, there is greater transparency of the health authorities in mainland and more rapid communication with Hong Kong on the surveillance of communicable diseases. The recent outbreaks in Guangzhou and Beijing are good examples. We realize that communicable diseases respect no national or territorial barriers, and we are all in the same boat. Second, there is greater awareness of the public on personal and environmental hygiene, at least for the time being. Some may even say that even the streets are cleaner today than they were a year or so ago. Third, the courage, professionalism, and dedication of the frontline workers in the healthcare profession have won the approval and admiration of the general public. The reputation of the medical profession, which was gradually sinking before SARS, has risen once again. Fourth, the courage, resilience, compassion, and generosity of the people in Hong Kong in the face of adversity were amply demonstrated during the SARS epidemic. I need not remind you of the sizable donations from the public to help the families whose member or members has succumbed to SARS. Finally, I dare say that contrary to adverse press reports, Hong Kong has come out of the pandemic much better than we expected. We are now better informed, more open, better prepared, and more united and positive in our attitude towards overcoming adversities. In our elated mood, as a result of the recovery of the economy and the absence of SARS this year in Hong Kong, let us not forget the difficult and challenging 100 days of the SARS epidemic and the 299 people, including 9 healthcare personnel, who had sacrificed their lives for the common good. We all know that Professor Trott is the doyen of medicine in Hong Kong. Perhaps more than anyone else to date, his vision and tireless efforts in teaching, research, and clinical practice have inspired generations of doctors and shaped the practice of medicine in Hong Kong, which is now widely acclaimed as being world-class. As founding president of the Academy of Medicine, he has nurtured the Academy through its formative years to maturity. Perhaps less known is his enthusiasm and interest in public health. He graduated from the University of Hong Kong in 1952 with many distinctions and prizes, including one in community medicine. For many years, he undertook to give lectures on communicable diseases to undergraduates. Ladies and gentlemen, I have a feeling that he would approve of what I've said today. Thank you.